title of my address tonight is the quotation from the Gemara Megillah. Megillah Mikra Senta, Megillah is a letter or a pistol. The Jewish destiny, the life of the book of Esther. The term Igeres in the book is simply a carnival, a tale of event. His excellence consists in honest, objective, and precise recording. The prerequisite Igeres must meet, comply with, are objectivity and honest and precise recording. Again, subjective coloring or slanting of events, omission of significant facts, or vice versa, overcrowding the narrative, the chronicle, with irrelevant details are unpardonable from the standpoint of the historian. And mind you, I'm not the historian. The Shibboleth appears as a chronicle of the historical narration is innocent. Nothing else but it. Yet the MS, the truth, in which the chronicler must comply, belongs to that kind of truth which we expect when we are called to the life, to witness it, hate it, to conform to, in any case of litigation or court proceedings. The truthfulness of the age of the witness is of a descriptive, matter-of-fact nature, concerned with exact, impartial, and detailed observation. The introductory phrase by Ibn Meir HaShemesh has what did it happen? So the answer is by Yidden Meir HaShverish. Fixing the time of the event. All those events which the Megillah is about to narrate happened in the time of HaShverish. Second, Igeres is more than a tale. This is the higher level. More than a descriptive chronicle, recording dry facts, naked, isolated events in chronological order. It's more than that. Igeres, at the second level, contains not just history, but a living history. The first level, that of description and observation, the Igeres is just a story. It's not history as yet. The second level, the Igeres becomes history, and history is living. The Igeres, at the higher level, is not only informing, as it is at the first level, but interpreting as well. It addresses itself at the second level, not only to the platitudinous, fact-prying, gossip, enjoying, excuse the colloquialism, nosy instinct, but to our knowledge-questing, inquisitive mind as well. Of course, Igeres, even at this level, was narrated. Certainly. Yet its main task is to explain, not only to tell a story. He gets at that level, not only describes, but also incorporates. It links up events, sets them up against their proper causal backgrounds, and points out their fundamental patterns of development. In short, at this stage, Igeres is not a descriptive chronicle or story, but interpretive history. Our rabbi said, Gemara Megillah, Mikra Sigeres, Shihitim Boshrei Shafutim Sherot, the scrolls must be held together by stitches. Three at least. Of course, the stitches symbolize the unity of the tale, the causative unfolding of the events, interpretation. At this level, the idea of emet, truth, is which the ideas at its higher level, they said before, must apply, is related to interpretation rather than to observation, as we have explained before. It is a truth achieved not just through careful, cautious observation, but through correct thinking, profound analysis, and thorough understanding of the events. By simply listening to the heartbeat of history, it is the kind of truth which is binding not on the witness, as the case was before, but on the dyer and the judge. In contrast to the heir, the witness is interested in the causal nexus of events, in motivation, interrelatedness, and interaction. The truth in this context is not descriptive, not matter of fact, but inventive, and I would say creative. What is Sefer vis-à-vis Igeres? Sefer in contradistinction to Igeres at both levels signifies certainly a book. But when the Gemara says Sefer, the Gemara had something else in mind. It's not just a book, but it's a book written under the impact of divine inspiration, under the integral influence of Ruach HaKodesh. It's a prophetic book. Sefer, as an inspired book, is not interested in a story. Nor is it concerned even with history. If history be understood as the science of individual events, as well as the science of one-timely occurrences that took place once and vanished into oblivion. Sefer, if it's a part of the Kisvei and the canon, is concerned not with individual events, but with universality, whose truth is not limited to a single epoch or particular set of circumstances that will hardly repeat itself. As I said before, for the Sefer, history ceases to be a science of the individual, particular single event, and becomes the metaphysics as the universal, general, symbolic, the constant and the perpetual law. The events for the tyrannical, they are events. For the sincere, they turn into symbols. For the tyrannical, historical figures, the actors in historical drama are people, live and die. For the sincere, historical figures that lived once upon a time become archetypes or prototypes whose image is stamped time and again upon all those who emerge in the historical arena. Thus, the seafarer does not tell us the story of yesteryear of an individual who lived and died long, long ago, or as a community of a certain day and age. What Sefer tells us, the perennial old new story of human destiny in general and Jewish destiny in particular. Sefer moves events from the particular, from the transient, and the one timely toward the universal, steady, omnipresent, and dynamic in the great drama of human destiny. At this point, the idea of truth transcends that of factual observation as well as that of causalistic interpretation, and reaches at the level of the sefer into the realm of inspiration. Truth, at this stage, is of a predictive nature. To be truthful means to be inspired, to enjoy clairvoyance, to see in every individual fact the fingerprint of universality, in each passive phenomenon, to see in each passive phenomenon what a certain historian Ranke called once the trends of the centuries and the traces of the millennia. The sensor sees in every individual fact a reflection of the internal, of the inevitable, and in each plot, the manifestation of the elan vital of human and Jewish destiny. The truth of the sensor is revealed, not discovered. He held as a vision, not just inferred by logical judgment. Numa gever shemei ha'imrikim, asher nachaze shadai yechaze, leifel ulei noim. Word of the man whose eyes true. In short, the Gilas Esther of the Sefer is a part of the Sefer Asfarim, of the canon of the Tisvei Kodesh. It is, I would say, an halachic book. My mind has expressed itself. Arihita Yemes, the scroll of Esther, will be as permanent, the Hamishok and Shetero, like the five books of Moses, like the statues of Torah Shabbat. It's an halachic book. that to live to these rules, principles and criteria, which should guide us as human beings and as Jews. And tonight, when I gave my topic in my address, I did not foresee the difficulties which I encounter in writing this paper. But once I said, I had to implement my promise. Tonight I wish to analyze just a few ideas which are relevant to our present involvement in the contemporary struggle. The Jews are now involved in a strange manner in the struggle between the two tigers, the East and the West, two systems of government, two societies, two communities, two philosophies. I would like to try tonight to interpret our unique position, in particular, and the struggle, the clash between the two tigers in general, in terms of medieval history, to study contemporary events in biblical and halachic categories. And I warn you, there is a subtle analysis. I wish you would pay attention later. You think, how do I know it's subtle? Perhaps it's bad. So you'll be the judges later. Let us just get a glimpse first, before we get involved in metaphysics, into the story of Esther. The story of Esther tells us in the most lively fashion, with a tinge of refined yet biting sarcasm, about paradoxical. Forgive me again, the use of the colloquialism. I would say crazy here. With that description, which are both tragic and comical at the same time. We are told a story about of a king who, as our rabbis Chazal have already remarked sarcastically, killed his beautiful, beloved young queen. It's quite possible she was his bride. At the suggestion, of his friend, the Nuhman. It's quite possible that the Nuhman was humble in church. And later, short time later, hanged his best friend, or the same friend, who in the meantime succeeded to rise to the top of the Persian hierarchy, or found the complaint of his beautiful queen and bride as well. It is a strange story, which is both, as I said before, sadly funny, about the king, per se, neither wicked nor well. Chazal say he was not too intelligent. But the story about the king, who signed upon the spur of the moment a decree, an edict, to exterminate a people whose identity he did not know, and about the people, to destroy the people, but whom he simply did not make any inquiry. And a short time later, forgot the whole incident, became very indignant. The next hour, following what the contents of the edict was. It is a story about a commonwealth where many races meet, many languages are spoken, many rituals and cults, practices. It is a story about a pluralistic society, there's no doubt about it. Culturally, religiously, in which suddenly decided to commit genocide for one reason only. The people who were to be exterminated were abiding by the religious statutes and laws that differ from those of other people. Something else is puzzling. It is almost frightening. It is a story about millions and millions of people among whom there were certainly countless liberal-minded, decent individuals who accepted the satanic, bloodthirsty, murderous, royally indifferently in cold blood. It's a story about a conspiracy of silence agreed to by the entire population of the great Persian Empire. No one interfered. And mind you, it's very simple. It was permissible to demonstrate the Shusha. Not what I've heard. I have the proof that it was permissible. It's quite obvious. Mordechai did parade in the streets at the capital, wrapped in sackcloth, his ashes on his head, and he cried with a bitter and loud cry. Mordechai even demonstrated in front of the royal palace. No guard blocked his way, but no one else joined him. Neither friends, he certainly had many friends, nor stranger. The Shushan no Deifer, the city of Shushan was perplexed. The Jews did not believe. They refused to face reality. The non-Jews did not care. Moreover, the story is puzzling from another viewpoint, because of a very strange coincidence. A short time before, the entire population was invited to the 7-day feast on the grounds of the royal palace. The invitations were extended to everybody, without a single exception, Jew and Gentile alike, to all races, faith, because in the given state, in unmistakable terms, the Holorom Manunti in the Shushan Abiro, and to all the people who were present in Shushan. They, of course, as guests of the king, fraternized, drank toast, shook hands, and hugged each other. And a little later, the ruthless, inhuman edict was issued and sent hastily with the couriers to all parts of the commonwealth, the Hashmid, the Harib, the Rabbi, to destroy, to slay, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day. And the question, I mean, rises spontaneously, how is it possible, we ask ourselves, that the same friend just a week ago, 2 weeks ago, before, I mean, shook hands with them, paid compliments to each other, and drank together, and ate together, and feasted together, should not raise their voice in protest. There is a very cryptic remark in the Megillah. For what sin you are to put in the Dvar HaMelech, the Ados Mitno Vishushan Abiro, HaMelech Verom on Yoshu Nishtes, Vishushan Avecho. The promise to went forth in haste, and the decree was given out in Shushan, and the king in Haman sat down to drink, and the city of Shushan was bewildered. Nothing to do with a sound translation. Novechem is the new word. The king and Haman celebrated. What? I don't know. You can tell me, I'm grateful to you. By feasting on a wine, I read somewhere, I don't remember where I was, that the dignitaries of the Nazi Party, after they had completed their work on the famous Meissensee document, dealing with the final solution of the Judenfrage, Siskret and Tildor, of Frankfurt and Beer, the Schwedes like the wine, they like beer, they are Germans. I believe that many questions rise, and I don't have to enumerate them. And I also believe the same questions are applicable to the more recent events, to the more recent epoch. It's almost a replica of what the McGinnis tells us. The one difference, as far as the story 2,500 years ago is concerned, it was just a conspiracy, which has never been implemented. In the 40s, it was not just a conspiracy. It was a reality. I don't like to complain, I don't like to ask for justice, I don't like to simply to tell the world, I mean, how cynically infected. I would like tonight, Spinoza said, not to cry, neither to cry nor to laugh, neither to criticize, nor to approve, nor to condone, but simply just understand. And here we are coming to a metaphysical analysis of man. I would like you to listen carefully. The answer to that riddle can be found in our philosophy of man as a dual dichotomous being, grounded in the inner contradiction and intrinsic conflict. It's within him. I said it on another occasion. It wouldn't do harm, I mean, to repeat it. Jihadism has never accepted the so-called two-band logic developed by Aristotle, whose foundation is the principle of contradiction and also the principle of the excluded middle. And Aristotle, in all simplicity, and I we can afford to be simple, we can't afford. We are complex natures. As that, if there is A and B, and A contradicts B, so either A is wrong or B is wrong. Both cannot be right. I said that quite often in the halakhic realm, speaking now about the halakhic concept, we ignore the Aristotelian principle as matter of physics to us. Yes, well, in the field of nuclear physics, both principles are errors, of course, being not abandoned but completely suspended, if necessary. The principle of contradiction and the principle of the excluded middle. The Halakha has known that secret for a long time. And the Halakha many times accepts both A and B, even though A and B are mutually exclusive. The Halakha believes that double V fuche, both can be true. But there is a possibility for a contradictio in the adjecto or objecto to be true without negating the truth of the opposite statement. I could prove it to you on purely halakhic grounds if I had more time tonight. Don't get scared of nothing. However, fundamental, not basic. We could get along with Allah, even with the Aristotelian principles, even accepting the principle of contradiction and that of the excluded middle. In Jewish philosophy, it would be impossible simply to understand or to comprehend the very essence of our world outlook, of our Weltanschauung, without abandoning or eliminating the Aristotelian principle or the Aristotelian two-valued logic. Let us now, pay our attention to Mary. Allah had a dialectical approach to man. There was a thesis, and there was an antithesis. On the one hand, jihadists looked at a man with a sympathetic, appreciative eye. Indeed, I would say with admiration. Could you tell me whether the term admiration is in the proper context? Did the others admire man or did they? What do you say about it? I said admiration. Should have stopped me. Is there a manifestation of admiration and great profound respect for man? Oh, there is. I believe it is in Psalm Chesed, not 8. It's 8, perhaps I make a mistake. Chesed. Kings that at Chasreyu Me'at Melekim, they covet Bo Odo Teatreyu. He's one bit lower than the ancients, and he's surrounded with dignity and majesty. Yehadus has time and again expressed faith in him. Not only Yehadus admired him, has also expressed faith in him. And believed in human uniqueness, in his royal status in nature, in his contemplative, meditative powers. After all, Yehadus said, is the only rational being in the universe. Perhaps you'll find some, distant star who were there. This thesis, that Jihadus had a sympathetic, optimistic approach to man, is correct, can be attested by something else, proven by something else. And I believe this proof is incontrovertible. The fact that Yehadus has granted man moral freedom, a complete, unrestricted, unqualified moral freedom. The human being enjoys unrestricted moral freedom. God does not want to interfere with the liberty. His man's liberty to plot his own existential thoughts. Apparently, man is deserving of freedom. Were man undeserving of freedom, he wouldn't have received that grant, the most precious of gifts which God had bestowed upon the world. On creation. It has not been granted to any other creature. Moral freedom, according to the Rambam, to Maimonides, is a tenet of power. In spite of the fact that he has not included moral freedom among the Shleish Esrei, the 13 articles of faith. On the other hand, Yehadus has treated man with extreme caution, I would say even suspicion, season. Concerning man is due to our historical experience and our long memory that has been hunting the Jews since time immemorial. Namely, the experience and the memory that man who is endowed with divine rationality may come at a moment's notice into either a non-rational or even an irrational being. And therefore, you have understood all extravaganza of man in strife. I was never too much impressed with the man visible per se. To never stand amazed or taken aback watching the latter then suddenly run amok. There is, in the opinion of Yahadus, no element of surprise in man's abrupt changes and unpredictable transformations. His unpredictability is a part of his humanity. And I would say his unpredictability is predictable. I just said that man is a child, man is a rational being. But he, by the way, frequently mentors into either a non-rational or an irrational being. So let me now analyze it. And here the analysis begins. It means that man has three alternatives. Three options. Either can be a rational being, or it can be a non-rational being, hyphenated of course. And if he wants, he can even become an irrational being. What do these three alternatives represent? Rationality, non-rationality, and irrationality. In order to understand exactly what is meant under non-rationality in terms of distinction and to irrationality, we must inquire into the source of the threefold schism in the human personality. We may ask what caused the threefold split, the triple conflict and feud within him. What lies at end? The following lies at end. Man is a limited being. He is burdened with finiteness. He is a finite being. And he is aware of it. He is simply burdened with finiteness awareness, where he himself experiences his finiteness. It's not something which has got to be told to him that you are a finite being, a restricted being, a limited being. He knows it. If he wants to know the truth, that he is finite. It's an awareness. He experiences existentially, metaphysically, his incompleteness and imperfection, his closeness to nothingness, He knows that his power is restricted. Knowledge will figure ebbing with age. Years, his years are numbered. Successes few. Frustrations many. And in general, his existential prospects are bleak. Per se, it is a metaphysical awareness. It's not a psychological awareness. It is a metaphysical, it's an existential awareness. It's a part of the greater awareness of that I exist. I exist as a limited being. I exist as a finite creature. I exist as imperfect and incomplete being. However, this metaphysical awareness is a distinctive awareness, not psychological. Like our consciousness of who we exist is not a psychological one. It's much deeper. It lies at the very root of the human psyche. The human psyche may express that awareness of I exist. But the I exist is the very root of our mentality and our psychological constitution. However, this knowledge, even though metaphysical, find its expression also in psychological experiences, in disordered moods, in man being dissatisfied with himself, disenchanted with the world, and who is not disenchanted with others, with themselves, fools are not dissatisfied. In being angry with everybody, including himself, it expresses itself in the restlessness of the young. I mean, not the young Americans of 1969-70. I mean, old-fashioned restlessness of the young. It's not something which you have discovered. I was also restless as a young boy, but I expressed it in a different fashion. I might say in a more dignified fashion. But there was dissatisfaction, there was rebellion, there was insurrection. In the restlessness, I don't know how they do it now, what girls used to do. Lock themselves suddenly up in a room, bury their heads in pillows and cry for no reason to justify that. This knowledge of finiteness, of imperfection and incompleteness, finds, as I said, its expression, manifestation in the young boys, disapproving of their parents, young boys hating Pa and being contemptuous of Ma, and parading and striking and demonstrating. It finds its expression in the loneliness and desolation of the elderly, and also in the fear of the middle age, who are about to become old, to get old. There are no reasons, if you investigate, to investigate everyone's mood, without passing mood, but nevertheless real, you wouldn't find any, you would not discover the theology, so to say, or the causal background of such people. Because they reach much deeper. They go back to the awareness and the I exist awareness, which is both affirming and negating. Yes. I exist, yes, affirming. At the same time, I exist as an imperfect being, as an incomplete being. All those moods, all those experiences, all psychological experiences, reflect fundamental awareness of man, of being incomplete, finite, and therefore consider his existence unwarranted and unjustified. I know what many of you think. I'm a pretty good mind reader. I'm among my stars, my pupils are. Abba Soloveitchik has become an existentialist. True or false, I don't know, perhaps I am. But I'm not, I am. If I am an existentialist, I'm not a Descartes or Heidegger or Jaspel. I am much older. And, you know, Bruce, I've seen something. The books of God. If there was an existentialist, then the greatest of all was the Descartes. And he spoke about the finiteness awareness, the awareness of incompletion, of incompleteness, and imperfection. What name did he find for that awareness? Not such a fancy name, it's finiteness. I don't know whether the term is grammatically correct. The term is grammatically correct. But however, what name did he point for that? The Sami speaks about Nima Makin Procession. The depth and profundis, out of which his cry rises to heaven. He also speaks about Minamata of a support from the strait of eternal, but from existential nearness to a support. What are those Minamata? What are a deep? What is that Minamata? What kind of strait are they? What are those Minamata? What is that? Minamata is not the experience of finiteness or metaphysical distress which abides in man. Interestingly, as the Zohar speaks of ten Minamata, ten aspects. The human awareness of incompleteness. Of course, I'll speak later about our halachic approach to the problem of the finiteness awareness, the problem of halachic. By the way, you wouldn't find it in Arabic. Yeah. But there is an Allahic interpretation and also a solution to the problem. Because as I'll explain to you later, we Jews have accepted that. Never resulted in it. Mother of man, when I say mother of man, perhaps the word mother is not fitting because it goes back to the Greeks of old. I mean the tradition which, the old tradition which mother of man has accepted. At the point of departure, this world outward, mother of man rejects the finiteness awareness. He does not look upon himself as if he were involved in Ma'amakim. He does not look upon himself as if he were, so to say, in the straits, all as it feels, no one to help him to get to the right land, or to get his freedom. Mother man wants to be more than he is in reality. He attempts to reach himself. He wants to achieve vastness. Boundless. He He resents boundaries in Jehovah. He wants to disobey doctrines and to rush toward infinity. Particularly, mother of man hates defeat. He cannot take defeat. Neither the individual nor the community can take defeat. Can our country take defeat in Vietnam? The people storm the gates of the White House, they don't understand that it's humanly impossible to take defeat. Defeat is imposed upon a human being. He never accepts it voluntarily. That's why America cannot just get out of it. It's not a political statement, it's a metaphysical statement.
The point of departure is a simple one.
the death experience or the fear of nothingness. Or we may say the finiteness awareness is, or as we as us, as the psalmist calls it, mimamaki, is inextricably intertwined with the I exist awareness. One has to pass through the light of the existential awareness, of the I existing awareness, in order to get to the chilling darkness of non-being of the grave. If one could stay forever in the beneficent twilight of a non-reflective peace, please listen carefully, of a non-reflective matter of fact, being without soul searching, without meditating, without trying to equate being with knowing, and without subscribing to the old idea that real is only who knows himself to be real. If man could do it, in other words, if one could suspend, or at least dim, obscure, the I exist awareness, he would not have to be burdened with the fear of death or the finiteness of awareness or the awareness of imperfection or incompleteness. But the question rose immediately, how can one suspend or at least eclipse a bit the I exist awareness? Because when a man enjoys his being in existence, then he begins to think of the other, of the opposite. Just as it is. The answer was, first, by abandoning the normal norm which is implied in the finite I exist awareness. The finite I exist awareness, there is a normal life. I exist for a certain time, for a very short time. My span of life is limited, and I am burdened with a task which I have to accomplish during that short span of life. In the I exist, there is another awareness implied. I exist, and I am duty-bound to utilize or take advantage of my existence to make my contribution of the greater harmony. Yes. There is a moral law. The moral law is intuitively implied in the I exist awareness. I crossed this valley only once, and during my journey, this world, I should leave my mark. I should leave traces. I should accomplish something. So first of all, if one wants to abandon the normal norm implied in the I exist awareness, then he will gain the awareness. The awareness will not be as intense and as overpowering. But how do you abandon the moral norm? Simply by intoxication or drunkenness. I don't mean intoxication with alcohol, drunkenness, with whiskey, but actually by intoxicating oneself. By the rapturous, hypnotic, hedonic experience. You know what hedonic is, but pleasure experience. Not as nice as it is. Which overpowers man which takes him out of the world of long time, of prospection and anticipation. For a just or geastic man, time is reduced to one dimension, the present moment. Of course, the obscuration of the I exist awareness and the surrender to Adonai, which is exciting and perplexing, is a result in the loss of rationality. Man is disciplined, courageous, and resents deceit. He wants to stay in the illumined spot, even though by enjoying the deadly light, he will have to cast a glance into the yawning abyss of horror. Rational man does not escape from reality, notwithstanding the fact, the unpleasant fact, that the reality he must encounter, the final reality he must encounter, is death. Rational man experiences being as a normative moral affair. I exist in order to accomplish. Orgiastic man forms the aesthetic society, the orgiastic society, whose prime objective is to enjoy and not to be aware either of being or not being. The hedonic society is non-reflective, non-meditating, non-introspective, non-self-appraising, or self-searching. The hedonic society is more or less a democratic society. Western society. In pursuit of pleasure and happiness. And that society, if you want to break down into world philosophy, its world outlook, its relation into the component, its component part. So this democratic society is in pursuit of pleasure, insists on minimum government interference in private life, presents controls, demands unrestricted freedom to in matters which don't affect the community, particularly, it is true, particularly matters of sex morality, hates discipline imposed on above, not even by teachers, is opposed to any threat, to any conscription, and does not like to pay high taxes. The motto of the orgiastic society, or call it hedonic if you have mercy on this society. I call it orgiastic society because our society is orgiastic. The orgiastic society, the motto of the orgiastic society was formulated long ago. How long ago, would you say? How long ago? Think of what the Shabbat. The hippies and the hippies did not discover it. How long ago, would you say? What? Since when? First, then there are models. It's almost an antediluvian. Vayiru b'nei elokim el b'nei Sodom k'tei leifeno vayikhu elokim mekeva shavohol. And the sons of the mighty, so the daughters of men, they are fair, and they took them to wives, whomsoever they chose, But the Torah underlines the phrase, not be like fair women. It himself to be so bad. But the freedom from any man, one of its systems, interfering with human agony. No authority, this world will be transcendental, may legislate how men should enjoy life. As long, of course, that they'll admit, as long as it does not infringe upon the rights of others. Orgiastic man does not only respond ruefully, enthusiastically, to inevitable biological urges. This wouldn't be bad, whose fulfillment yields pleasure. But experiments with the idea and how to precipitate new pressures and unheard of, newly contrived artificial situations which help you challenge the body to respond by engaging in gratifying action which is completely unnecessary. In short, our Western society is the typical representative of the aesthetic society, which actually originated, the real founder of the aesthetic society. Who is the real founder? We speak about founding fathers. Who is the, here happens to be a founding mother. Who is he? Other thoughts. A favor issue of Katerina for Maho, the Ricardo Ivo Enoim, the Nachman Zerim Oim for Haskell, Batika, Mikirin, Matera. In that moment, Western society was founded and incorporated. Actually, the one who took the charter out for the Hedonic society was he. To tell you that the Torah hated orgiastic men, not only resented, hated, abhorred, is unnecessary. And the censure or the rebuke against orgiastic men or Hedonic society was formulated in the Torah where? Where? Where do you say? That side. You will sit on my right. I believe the rebuke or Hedonic life was censured in the 10th commandment. The Zachar. Thou shalt not covet, shalt not desire something which is beyond your reach. One must not stretch out his hand for sense infinity. Spiritual infinity is great. Sense infinity is corrupting and abominable. For carnal boundlessness, for the vastness that the flesh demands of man. The Torah teach condone a pleasant, happy, and gracious life, provided that enjoyment is founded. And the calling of the blood is moderate. One may pursue pleasure according to our viewpoint if he knows how and when to retreat and withdraw. How many times did it take in the Torah how many times did Hedonic society come to the foreground, the foreground, to the surface, as far as the accounts of the Pentateuch are concerned? How many times does the head of Pentateuch recorded the emergence of Hedonic society into the historical biblical arena? How many times? So every four times, orgiastic men appeared, and God, who is patient and kind and benevolent, punished him severely. Of course, the first was Eve. The second, of course, the orgiastic society, orgiastic men of their mother. Now the third, the third. Ah! I can hear it. The dumbest, about the dumbest prayer. They deserve special attention. I don't believe that the dumb belongs to the group, to the group. The dumb society was orgiastic or perhaps, but, he was a cadaver. He was a cadaver. The people in the desert and they shouted and demanded flesh, meat, quail. They were overcome by lust. And the wind from the north started up, swept quail from the sea, and threw them over the camp. And the people sat together in quail all the day and night. The meat was still between their teeth. When the anger of the Lord blazed forth. And finally, the fourth time, the famous Baal-Peor episode by Yochanan Mizneis as Bnei Smeov, the people began to commit adultery with the Moabite women. And now I wish to emphasize something. When I speak of orgiastic men or the Hedonic society, I'm not referring exclusively to carnal hedonism, to real hedonism of the flesh, like gluttony or promiscuity. I don't refer it exclusively. What is known, I don't refer to what is known in medieval scholastics, and I always find it hard to pronounce, as concupiscence. You know what it is? I don't know. It's lust, more or less it's lust. It's more or less it's something done better. As a matter of fact, let us be truthful, Western world is addicted to this strange, let me say again, concupiscence. That the world is lusty, is in pursuit for pleasures of the flesh. No sex morality, so-called sex morality, of the characters of it. Can I test what I say? That the world is addicted to this kind of enemy. Many Europeans, and I may say, I mean, not my patriotism, shouldn't I? I'm a patriot, but an American, but many European, particularly Scandinavian countries, have reached absolute proportion in their liberality and legislation pertaining to sex laws or sex habits. However, when I say heavenly, this is clear in all the sense of the Greek term. When I say heavenly, I refer to human questing for all goods at the senses. If the element of boundlessness or the drive for infinity, for vastness, or the element of overreaching oneself, of trying to grab more than I can consume, is present. Whenever with a fantasy, because it's an aesthetic experience, it's also an experience, a fantastic experience. Whenever the fantasy begins to stimulate man and to stir in him unqualified yearning for the finite goods of sense, they are goods. But they are finite, and they are not goods of the spirit, they are goods of the sense. Be it money, be it large estate, be it lust, sex lust, be it delicious food, be it social prominence, so-called publicity. Wherever desire, unlimited desire, rises, or just big man emerges into the arena. The mind is the miser. Kind of a miser described by Gogol, others, who keeps on piling up gold coins, who without spending a nickel on himself, starving, dressed in rags, is also a funny way orgiastic. He belongs also to the hedonic society. For he cannot satiate his hunger for God. And if there is no satiety, then man is orgiastic. Whether orgiastic man is industrialist or thinker, or a Casanova, or Napoleon, or even a great scientist. Doesn't matter. What is important? The tale of imagination weaves a halo around goods, finite, a halo of infinity, around finite goods of sense. And they find, they are mistaken, but they think they have found self-fulfillment in finite goods of sense. And terminal is in the Western society, I mean, the hedonic society who tries to find self-fulfillment in the finite goods of sense. There is another society, because there is another path upon it, which human beings take in order to escape from the finiteness awareness, in order to engage in self-deceit, not only in an illusion, but simply in a delusion. The second path, along which frightened men, modern men, travels in his wild flight from finiteness, death means, as I have said before, in the opposite direction. Instead of dimming, while orgiastic man dims his awareness, his I exist, and I must accomplish awareness. Instead of dimming, exist awareness and surrendering to sensuous rapture that link man's attempts to enhance and to exalt his I exist awareness. Man at this stage, traveling along the second path, rise to a car, the fear of finiteness, through a big lie. You know, the method of the big lie was initiated by Goebbels, taken over by Khrushchev, transmitted to Timo Messina himself, I'm sure, transmitted to Brezhnev, little by little handed down to Western society as well. So the big lie, he convincing himself that he is more than man, through intentionally magnifying the hundredfold and exaggerating and lying about human ability and power to solve both scientific and metaphysical problems of humanity by simply painting iridescent colors and at the eschatological age we should be brought about by man alone through his wisdom and creative effort. I believe that you know what I'm referring to. In a word, man wants to defeat, who travels along the second path, who wants to defeat his anxiety, serving death, his finiteness, to setting himself up as a deity, powerful, wise, and creative, the awareness I exist, extending to a larger awareness, I do exist as creator, as mighty ruler, legislator, and final authority. And something happens. I mean, whoever, of course, I mean, that with this method has been employed by all humanists. I mean, those humanists who wanted to replace transcendental morality with man-made morality. It's certainly true of the Marxist world outlook. It's to say that Marxism has taken an optimistic approach to man. Not to fight. They simply, they adore man. People admire but adore. And they not only idealize man, but they idolize man. And by idolizing man, setting him up as a deity, no wonder that there is a certain idolatrous cult develops there from time to time. Like the cult of Lenin, I mean of Stalin, the present cult of Lenin, the cult of Mao Zedong, and so forth and so on. Because basically, fundamentally, they try to overcome human finiteness, human imperfection, by idolizing themselves. Of course, if people, I mean, it was hard to find a proper term how to describe that man. I call him arrogant man. I mean, it's good. Arrogant man who wants to erase his finiteness experience through self-idolization, his attention, he must shift his attention from the individual to the society, from the single person to be wounded. To mankind, because they idolize the individual with an unsensible death there. Their larger society, mankind, humanity, is idolized, deified, and set up as the omnipotent deity. For humanity as such, no single individual, viewed in the opinion of self-sufficient, arrogant man, redeemed itself from bondage. Only mankind itself can accomplish to liberate itself. The idol is the class, not the individual. Of course, the individual who is idolized is the image of the class. He is, so to say, the substitute for the class. He represents the class. But through Lenin, through Mao Zedong, and through Stalin, the class was idolized. This other elegant society is unfortunately not pleasure-seeking, not at all. On the contrary, an ascetic streak runs through this society. In the name of some doctrine or code, man-made of course, they appeal for sacrifices. They are low in conscience, in contradistinction to Western man, the abundant man. They are low in conscience, and duty oriented. In the name of a doctrine, on behalf of an ethical code, which was legislated by man, they are out to conquer or destroy the world. There is no third option to them, no third alternative. The human man is ultimate. Every human formulated doctrine becomes a credo, an article of faith, whose cogency must not be doubted, and woe to the writer who doubts the absolute cogency and veracity of a Marxist doctrine. So, in other words, arrogant man becomes a tyrant, and the society turns an elegant society that he establishes turns it into a tyrannical society. The tyrannical elegant society is bold and aggressive, trampling upon individual freedom and personal dignity. The elegant society scoffs at human faith in God, and considers faith in a transcendental existence as a human weakness. Arrogant man is well organized, disciplined. Their undertakings are bold in design and daring in execution. Did such a society exist? In people, of course, that they are at war. Arrogant tyrannical society was portrayed in Chumash by the day of war. It's a very strange generation of us. Let me just read two verses from the Chumash. And they said to one another, come, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and slime for mortar. And he said, come, let us build a city, and a tower with its top in heaven. It is hard sometimes to identify whose words we just heard. Are they the words spoken by fanatical, vainglorious men of old of antiquity, marry this widow after day. Arrogant men, while orgiastic men is non-rational, arrogant men is irrational. Why? Why? Am I one to understand? Non-rational man means simply, man simply has cast off, shed his rationality. Irrational man means man who has a rationality, but it's funny one. Irrationality is very rational. There is reasonableness to irrationality. There is no reasonableness to non-rationality. For there is system, there is continuity, there is unity, there is consistent to irrationality. Non-rational man rejects norms. Non-rational man is basically an agnostic. He refuses to accept a transcendent law. However, he knows well that the norm legislated by him is of no value, is relative. Non-rational man is not destructive, is not satanic, is not diabolical. He's simply a fool. Non-rational man, or orgiastic man, hates evil. He certainly does hate evil, even though he lacks the instrument to check it. But there is one instrument to check evil. This is the transcendental law. By rejecting the transcendental law, man has lost the instrument with which he could check it. Arrogant man is irrational because he is satanic, diabolical. He legislates norms, defines doctrine, formulates articles of faith, and ascribes to all those irrational things ultimate worth. There is something else. Irrational man may write, not only may write, he had written already a code of immorality. Immorality itself becomes a norm. Murder, they tell, is a noble deed within the frame of reference of irrationality. Has not, I mean, Nazi Germany is the best example. Many who killed Jews, burned Jews in the California, saw that they are actually accomplishing something. They are conforming to great moral law and are implementing the moral law. While agnosticism is non-rational, metaphysical arrogance, which leads to idolatry, results is irrational. Arrogant man. In fact, who was the first arrogant man who wanted, so to say, to replace God, or to play God, or relate claim on ultimate validity of doctrine, law, and man? This one, I don't know what he was, but was quite clever and capable. This was our old friend, the serpent. The Nohash HaKadmeget. Quite clever. And he told Eve, Ki yedei arikim v'yimacholchem enanu v'nifkechu eneichem v'yisem kerikim yedei vora. The job of man is to replace the Almighty. Nasa lo v'nigdol v'reshe v'ashamayim. This is easily felt. And again, the Terre has forbidden arrogance, metaphysical arrogance. Where? While Adonai was forbidden by the 10th commandment, metaphysical arrogance was forbidden by the 1st commandment. Onech la Hashem lekecho, le'yiloch elohim acherim oponai. And the incarnation, the personification of irrationality, of arrogance, which is evil, is who? Nochasha is just self. But the Nochasha, if we had him around, could settle our accounts with him. But he's not around. That's what we understand under, by the concept Amalek. But at least what the Chachmei HaKabbalah and the Kabbalists have understood. Not a genuine pride, not a race, but evil. When Satan, who writes a code to kill and to oppress and to lie, and here, something strange happens. The Torah has portrayed orgiastic man, arrogant man, through two societies. The Jera Mahu, orgiastic man and arrogant man in their societies, the aesthetic, and the arrogant tyrannical society by introducing two generations. As the whole reason of the Torah did it, the Torah meant to do it in order to show the transition. As a rule, orgiastic society succumbs to tyrannical, arrogant society. I would even say, orgiastic society gradually, little by little, piecemeal, turns into a tyrannical, arrogant society. A pleasure-loving speech is ready prey to the intrigue, to the scheming of our hungry, satanic mind. There's too much involved in the orgiastic members himself. All his talents are concentrated to the good. His imagination sees objects at his desire, nothing else. He doesn't see people, he has no historical sensitivity. A Jewish man lacks historical intuition. He cannot behold historical vision. He's too much involved in the present. He's too much absorbed in heaven. The non-rational orgiastic man lacks historical intuition, sensitivity to events. He doesn't feel the heartbeat of history. He is much absorbed in his hedonic experiences. He overemphasizes foolishly the ideal of freedom that happened in 1917 in Russia. His currency had a little bit of intelligence. No communist revolution would have taken place. He overemphasizes the importance of freedom. He simply lacks the courage, the vision, and the power of anticipation. He lacks the predictive element in history. He does not experience it, since he lives just for the present. And little by little, his power is eroded, and he is replaced by the irrational man, who is time-conscious and future-oriented. That happened in Germany. I was there so many years ago, in the late 20s, early 30s, another indulgent, permissive, and the main drunk society, and the society in our country now, is tolerated, even promoted the rise to power of the tyrant and madman, He was not, and the madman was not non-rational. Had he been in there, he would have never left it one day. He was irrational with a peculiar demonic diabolical logic and will thinking. He was dedicated to an absolute norm of his own thinking, the norm of immorality. And the same thing happened in the Western world, where the so-called youth movement, rejecting all norms, every semblance of regulated, self-limiting life, and preaching boundless liberty, freedom from all authority, are actually blazing the trail for irrational men to come and to take over. And the same happens in the time of Aishwarya. What do we see when the curtain rises on the first act of Nihila Festa? What do we see? What do you see on the stage? What do you see? The feasting, pleasure-loving, and pleasure-pursuing society. The Book of Esther did not spare words in portraying vividly, with refined artistry and sarcasm, the repugnant addiction of the king, the princess, courtiers, and servants to lascivious pleasure, to the incessant pursuit of an ever fugitive satisfaction, the habits of an orgiastic society that was tired and exhausted because of satiety, and yet anticipated another satiety to be tried, for the sheer novelty of it is clearly portrayed. Why was it necessary to perpetuate the names of the eunuch, the names of the harem keeper, Shazgar, Hagoy, the brand of cosmetics used by the king's concubines, the foul and rude habits of the king himself, the scripture which is so tangled about the life that called its Abraham, became suddenly so loquacious in narrating the story of the king's wife, Bainkness, and the degenerate life at all? The answer is simple, because only with such non-rational environment could irrational men take the right. Only people who were pleasure-pursuing had no fixity, no fixed norms, no ultimate validity, no doctrine. Everything was shifting like this pendulum could tolerate immense Satan, irrational and destructive and poor. Only people addicted to peaceful and pleasant could stand by and watch the smoke rising from the crematoria chimneys and climbing to heaven. Vayi b'mei Achashverosh. Do you know why this bloody nonsense happened? Because it was a Achashverosh era. Uvona kedemei and freedom from the morning of heaven. ויהי אחר הדברים האלה, the society of Shashgas and Hagoy must produce a haven. It was true 7 years ago, it is true today as well. Now, if you're not tired, nor bored, I would like to tell you what is the Jewish approach to the finiteness awareness. How do we handle that? We saw modern man in two different ways. In an arrogant way and an hedonic way. Of course, Yahavis, as I said before, object to the two solutions, which orgiastic and arrogant tyrannical men suggested. Yahavis assert that the mamakim awareness can never be cast off. Never. Woe is to the man who tries to shed off the mamakim awareness. Can never be cast off, suppressed, or changed by man. The latter must abandon those childish satisfactions, the HDNA and the big lies. Make, reconcile with the finiteness awareness. and abolish all things of spiritual dwelling. And Yahadus developed, in my opinion, four aspects of the finiteness awareness. There are four dimensions to the finiteness awareness. First of all, the metaphysical dimension. Men cannot and must not attempt to suspend the finiteness awareness, for the latter is interwoven into the texture of the I-exist experience. Hence, man alone is unable to free himself from all the symptoms of that awareness, such as the feeling of loneliness, boredom, frustration, anguish, fear. Man is certainly incapable to defeat death. Salvation of man can come only from God. His companionship will heal man from the anxiety of being incomplete, finite, impatient. It is principle number one. Science will never solve the metaphysical problem of man. And all my respect to the psychiatrist will never heal man from the finiteness awareness or from the experience of Ma'amakim or Minameitzar Kavasikon. Now, don't listen to the beautiful, so to say, beautiful exposés and lectures delivered usually by non-scientists, by platitudinous people, about the prospects of psychiatry and the knowledge and the science of the mental processes of man. They'll solve the existential problem of man. Never, otherwise. Because solve the metaphysical, and I speak about psychiatric problems. I want you to know, insanity is a psychiatric problem. Metaphysics does not know insanity. But metaphysical problems of man will express themselves psychologically in a variety of manifestations. The variety of aspects can never be cured by man. Only salvation from God. Certainly not fear of death, nor death itself can be eliminated by man. I don't believe that medicine will at any time, 1,000 years from now, reach the stage at which it will be able to turn man into an immortal being. Of course, we believe in immortality, and we also believe that someday, even psychosomatic man will be immortal. But only when it will be God's will to do so. Second, Yahadus believes that exploration of the entire universe, of the universe and its outskirts and its fringes, exploration of the boundless stretches and gray uncharted plains of the astral world will never be completed. Yes, Yahadus has encouraged men to explore, to conquer, to rule, and the latter may explore limited astral sectors, even the entire solar system, and if he wants to believe and to dream, he may make a trip. I don't know how long it will take, but according to what physicists say, in keeping with Einstein's theory, if a young man will start out for a star in a different system, and he'll come back home, he'll be as young as he was on the day of departure. All right? The only question is whether he'll come back home. But however, yes, and I don't believe in it. I'll even say that we'll be able to get out of our galaxy
And the Milky Galaxy, and then reach another galaxy. But this is just a small corner in the universe. The entire universe will remain an unknown mystery. The boundless uncharted plains of the dark spaces and galaxies will remain closed to man. The reason for this is a simple one, because man is finite, and who knows what the universe is. And finite man cannot explore infinity and boundlessness. Number two, renowned scientism, not scientism, but pseudoscientism, has become a religion for many, a cult. It is just as idolatrous as the cult of Stalin and Mao Zedong. And just as foolish. Just as foolish. Third, men will never find the answer to the mysterious magnum question. How does the universe function? You'll never answer that question. Men have accomplished a great deal with his quantifying mathematical method. However, he just establishes abstract relationships, answering the how question from within, without answering the why question from without. That will remain a secret. The mysterium magnum, mysterium tremendum, will never be resolved. Unless God will the eschatological age to commence. Fourth, men cannot and men must not legislate the moral norm. Men should be either ready to accept morality from God or give up any attempt to live a moral life. Because in position of a secular code, secular finite relative code upon society is in vain and is worthless. In my opinion, that's exactly what the original sin, the Hetakadmi, consisted of. Adam tried to do it, to impose, to legislate norms of good and bad, and brought disaster upon himself and mankind. Irrational man does it with arrogance, and he ends up with the law, with the moral law of immorality. So Judaism has accepted all four major aspects, and those four major aspects are former mocking, the mocking consciousness, as unalterable, God-willed, inevitable experiences of defeat. Judaism, it's very important, has spoken so beautifully of Trilas Velov. It's very strange that our teachers consist of two colors. Trilas Velov. White and blue. What kind of blue? Rambam says, blue at noon. The color of the sky at noon time. Deadly. Light blue. Definitely white. Rashi says it is the color of the evening sky, dark blue, bordering on the planet. And it's quite interesting. When the Mishnah asked the question, when is one supposed to reach Ma? So the answer is, Mishiyakir v'treves v'lovan, when he is ready to discriminate, or is able to discriminate between blue and white. Discriminate where? This is called Tadir Shalve. If you just pull out the stickers and try to discriminate between one or two threads of blue four threads of blue and the white threads. What is the white color? The white color in Hebrew language, in Hebrew semantics, is the symbol of plainness, simplicity, intelligibility, and familiarity, friendship. If you want to say it is clear, it is certain, it is undoubted, it is without, it is, there is no doubt about it, doubtless, you say Kashemesh Batsalayim. It's as the dazzling light coming upon us from the heavens. When the writer disagrees with the Rambam and rebukes him, he says, Lenoyel, Lechoyel, Leboya. There is no light, there is no whiteness, it's dark. What does the Tehillah color represent in Yahadus? The Gemara asks, and the Gemara answers, Tehillah Bein Aleyam. The blue color is reminiscent of the large sea, of the immense vastness of the sea, Yam Bein Elokia. The sea reflects the blueness of the sky, the Rokia Bein Elokia Koveit, and the sky, the heavens, reflect the glory of the celestial form of the transcendental Rebbeinu Shalom. Tehillah color, what did the Gemara want to express by it? The Tehillah color reflects distance, remoteness, beyond reach, the vast expanse of the sea, and the boundless astral distances. It reflects impenetrable mystery, enveloping the destiny of man. The tremor and fear, inspired by the incursion from time to time of the unknown, transcendent into our lives. It happens quite often. Yehadus warned man not to be too sure of himself, not to be overconfident, not to be too cocky, so to say, and not to be over sophisticated, too clever. And the others kept on telling us, and this runs like a red thread throughout our literature, from antiquity until the Sifrim, to the Sifrim Musa of contemporary scholars. There are intelligible factors in reality which are flooded with the white, dazzling light. Everything in those sectors is clear, understandable, and intimate. In those sectors, one enjoys warmth and sweetness. However, there are also sectors enveloped in the dark blue of the mysterious evening sky, where man feels like a homeless wanderer who just happened to cross into a strange, foreboding territory. The transition from one sector, from the white sector, to another is quick and sudden. Tehillah of the evening sky replaces Lavan of the bright day unexpectedly. How was it by the night of the autumn? How was it 7 years ago? We don't try to invest to explore our own experiences. How was it? It was very simple. I was enjoying the bright day of my life, full of color and sun. I 3 years have passed since I went through a serious abdominal operation, and God helped me to recover from that illness. There was, Baruch Hashem, no recurrence. It seemed to me as if everything was going to be simple, white, and magnificent, like the dazzling light of the noon sky, and that I'll be able to study Torah mitoch osher, of course, with an aleph, not with an ayin. And the same evening, she told me, I have to enter the hospital for just observation. And suddenly the bright day, in a matter of minutes, turned into a dark, bleak, dreary, appointed night. Transition from love to tears is a very quick and abrupt one. How was it in Shushan? A beautiful. A day before, they kissed it. Jewish Empire, courtier, and Ishihudi, together, drank toast and hugged each other. And in a matter of hours, the pistols were sent out with the couriers. Lehashmi, leharei, leharei, to destroy, to slay, and to kill. Yahadus says, I'm sorry, it's contrary to the American philosophy of pursuit of happiness. I'm sorry, I have to be lapicurus as far as the Declaration of Independence is concerned. You'll excuse me, I mean, we have an Irish sheet of people who watch for it because it, watch out for it. I should not be clear. I'm going to go as a precursor. The pursuit of happiness contradicts the finiteness awareness. And the finiteness awareness in Yahadus expresses itself in one word: man's insecurity vis-à-vis the future. Because man is a being who lives in time. He does not live in the present moment. The present moment is only a link. He lives in the past. And he lives in the future. He remembers the past and anticipates the future. He feels nostalgia as far as the past is concerned. It's a devastating nostalgia. Many things he could have accomplished, and he didn't. I would give my right arm, to use a colloquialism, if I could just speak for 5 minutes. With one of the 3 people I just lost 3 years ago. Just for 5 minutes. I tried to speak to them, standing at their grave. Today, to the fair grave, I addressed myself there. There was no answer. Or perhaps the answer was lost, I don't know. I couldn't hear. This is the nostalgia for something that was within my reach, and I did not exploit the opportunity, I did not take advantage of it. Kind of nostalgia, Merochei Kadishem Nirei, one begins to appreciate God when he is at a distance from him, remote, when God is very close, orgiastic man doesn't appreciate him. Nostalgia is a part of the human mima maki, but there is insecurity in the future. I tried to gain a glimpse in the future. Only fools can speak of security, unless they identify security with the stock market. It's a very bad equation now. But what do you mean, man's security? I always say, now I move my finger, my index finger. But I'll be able to move the finger 5 minutes from now. God knows, I don't know. And
Chazal has proceeded every morning. The man wakes up, stands on his feet, as the day of Tchiyas Hamesim. Because unconscious man regained his consciousness. The miracle of Tchiyas Hamesim in miniature, according to Chazal, happens and occurs every morning. The sleeping man, unconscious man, wakes up and regains his awareness. I do exist. And my existence as a practice most probably. Man's insecurity, this is actually the word which expresses in total the finiteness, awareness, the mina mitzah, what he called. Oh, mima makim chasicha v'shem. And man's insecurity lies at the very root of prayer. Without the finiteness awareness, without man's insecurity, there would be no prayer. The latter is the response to human misery stemming from the mima makim awareness. So let me just explain to you in short. Prayer, whether of biblical or rabbinic origin, doesn't matter now. We don't have to engage in the controversy between the Rambam and the Ramban, whether prayer is midraise or midrabbanan. But whether biblical or rabbinic bears witness to one unalterable fact, namely that man is always in need. He has to emphasize the petitional aspect of feeling. Hymnal, prologue, and epilogue are just secondary, of secondary importance. The act of praying is the religious response to need, to the experience of sorrow, of distress, existential straits, narrowness. Minamita, when men feel trapped and defeated, many passages in the Bible will confirm that the link of sorrow is filled. בצר לכל מצוך כל הדברים האלה, מן המיטה כבר שיקור, תפילו לא נקייה עדית, כאילו כאילו לא מעזבת לי, the chapter which Esther recited when she was about to enter the royal court. Only then is prayer meaningful when he dawns up a man, and another man is too foolish, and he is not conscious of it, that his situation is a tragic one, that he is utterly defeated, that there is nobody to help him but God. Prayer and crisis are inexplicably linked up. Of course, the question rises immediately. If the crisis awareness is indispensable for prayer, how can prayer be recited daily? At times of peace and prosperity and success and victory, how can I say Rufain Rav Hashem Ben Rofe if I just this morning, I mean, came from the doctor and gave me a thorough checkup and gave me what we call it in colloquial English, a clean bill of health? So what sense does the Rufain have? Or what sense does the Baruch Aleinu, the same Baruch of the Adama have if I have a fat bank account in the bank? Do it have a sense or doesn't it have a sense? Apparently it has a sense. What is the sense? In the insecurity of man. Now I'm healthy. How I'll feel next morning, I don't know. There is future and present linked up. And this is the idea of prayer. And this lies at the root of the idea of prayer, the finiteness of awareness of man. It is his nostalgia, devastating, completely unreal. He wants something which he can never get. He wants contact with the world which is gone long ago. He wants communication, communion with persons who are not here around anymore. They are far, far away. He wants many things. Because he was a fool, he missed them while they were out. He could just have all he had to do is to stretch out his arms. He could reach them. He could have reached them.
An insecurity of man. The seventh aspect, a crisis, of the finiteness of awareness, of his mocking human nature.
Now let me just
finish.
However, prayer in the others, I want you to understand that, is not just a recital. It is more than that. It is a world outlook, and it is also a way of life. Because prayer, what is the term, the Halachic term for prayer? Tefillah is alive, of course. But there's another term, the prime term for prayer. Aveda Shabbat. Aveda means, if you work, if you translate prayer into daily, into your daily life, into deeds. Of course, we said that prayer is the answer which Yehadus gives, or the response of Yehadus to the Minamakim or Minamitzah awareness. The question is, yes, it is the answer. The insecurity of man, when I am with God, I feel secure. And that's why, in my great agony and misery, on a period not 3 years, but almost 7 years, I found companionship in the Torah. I've never learned as much as I did in the last 7 years. Because I felt, while I studied, I've been studying, that someone behind me stands behind me, casting a furtive glance, leaning over my shoulder, and casting a furtive glance into the blood in my head, and silently asking me, what are you saying? And that awareness of unseen presence has kept me, has guided me, has made me survive, physically and intellectually and emotionally. Prayer is not enough. There must be a way of life which is prayerful, saturated with the idea of prayer, permeated with the philosophy of prayer and the metaphysics of prayer. What is the way of life on which prayer reflects? Let me tell you that now. I'm finished. A prayerful life signifies first a consecrated life. Yehadus believes that each man, I mentioned it last year, but I'm developing it in a different fashion. Yehadus believed that each man has an assignment. The man is not born, is not cast, as the existentialists say, into this world in vain. For no purpose, for no reason, is burdened with an assignment. Each man, in the opinion of Yehadus, is anointed, not appointed. Appointed, yes, but even anointed by the Almighty to contribute something to redemption, to the arrival of the eschatological age, to the great redemption. In other words, a drop of the holy oil, Shemen HaMishrei, of consecration, fell on the head of every Jew. He is called to participate in the great march of generations. We have been blazing the trail for the Melech HaMashiach since the dawn of our history. Each Jew is the harbinger of the Melech HaMashiach. Where is a Melech HaMashiach in the nature all by himself? Because he blazes the trail.
for the great Melech HaMashiach. Any Jew has a messianic eschatological assignment. And any Jew should think, I was born for one purpose only. This is the prayerful way of thinking. To serve. God has laid claim on me. Has laid claim on me. Or does lay claim on me. He wants me for his service. It's a plain pasuk in Israel. The old Jewish hymn, which has been echoing through the millennia and centuries, certainly says that man belongs to God. If entire creation is his property, so man, Allah has come and come. And if he belongs to God, so he is consecrated to the service of God. He is a Messiah in miniature. And when I speak of service, I mean two kinds of service. One service is the continuous one. Life itself is a service. Takarish Baruch. If man knows how to live, if man knows how to plot his course, if a man knows how to respond to experiences, if man knows how to pray and how to treat his fellow man, this itself is a service. However, there is another service, a one-kindly service, which in times of emergency, with a special urgent appeal, I address my God. To man, reaches him. Such an appeal, you know very well, was addressed, and perhaps my wife used to say, this is the gist of the entire Megillas Esther, was addressed to Esther. Such an appeal. It was just one time, in a crisis, in an emergency situation, was an appeal addressed to Esther. Loving Lifnei HaMelech, HaMelech will evacuate in front of Allah. Such an appeal was addressed to Abraham, even though Abraham's life in its entirety was a service to God, was consecrated. But no one can get away from the one family appeal, which begins to echo through the uncharted spaces, separating us from the Almighty. Kach lo esbircho es echidcho, es yitzcho kasher hafto. Such a petition is submitted to each individual who wants in a life. The service which individual is called upon to perform is singular, which only he, the individual to whom the appeal was addressed, is capable of rendering. No one else can do the job which Dashkoch has assigned to him. The service requested of Esther was of a singular nature, and according to Mordechai's philosophy, Esther, who was born and made clean, in order she should perform one service, which took her just a couple of hours. Midera, in Leitzko days, Kadat Ramalkus, who knows, whether thou art not come to the royal estate for such a time as this. I will just add two words. And who knows, if you hadn't been born just for that purpose. And who knows if God hadn't bestowed little charm upon you just for that purpose. The time has come. The call was sounded. Esther was sounded. This is one prayerful way of life. Of course,
Now the second aspect is a messianic consecrated life, a life of service, is ipso facto a courageous life. It's a courageous life. What does a courageous life mean? I would rather use the term heroic.
Why?
It's a heroic life. And I have been saying it for a long time. If someone should ask me, what does Yahavusu want of us? I would give him one answer. To live heroically. To live courageously. To live this fortitude. I would give him one answer. To live heroically. To live courageously. To live this fortitude. Heroic life, Yahavus disliked cowardice. Yahavus had contempt. I wouldn't say dislike, had contempt. For a mercantile logic. The logic of a businessman. I am not present company experience. There is some businessman there, I know that. The businessman logic, the pragmatic utilitarian logic, which is too astute and too cautious, and which tells man that he must not begin unless he knows for sure that he is able to fix it. Courageous life or heroic action is based fundamentally, motivated not by pragmatic, utilitarian, mercantile, discursive, logical reasoning, because this reasoning is at best a coward. It's backwards. But is motivated, but is inspired rather by intuitive insights, by spiritual perceptions which are beyond the reach of the logical formal analysis. As a matter of fact, the most important decision, as a matter of fact, this is true of every man, Jew and non-Jew alike, the most important decisions in one's life are reached in the intuitive rather than in the logical dimension. The Jew of old, the dying woman, and the Jew of today, who has to do the same job, to defy not only one woman, but the entire world, is not guided by syllogistic inferences. Because had he been very guided by those inferences, he would never dare to defy the world, to confront the world. Had he made an inquiry of the strictly practical, a bit pompous logos, he would have received an answer in the negative. From the logical, rational viewpoint, those relations, those rebellions, this defiance, this type of confrontation is plainly suicidal. Mordechai's defiance of Haman was suicidal. Esther's risking her life and with it the lives of millions of Jews was logically unwarranted. She did because, as Chazal said, the Spirit of God has descended upon her, she was inspired. And, in conclusion, a courageous life, a service life, dedicated to service, means a heroic life. A heroic life means sacrificial life. And the highest form of sacrifice for a human being is not to give his life. No.
The highest form of sacrifice, again, you have this understood it, is his readiness to leave the stage after he had played his part assigned to him and vanish in anonymity and oblivion. More than a person wants to live, a person wants to be remembered. Remembered by individuals, remembered by society. Remember that he has accomplished something. This quest for being remembered, for not being forgotten, is so powerful. I remember, I myself can reproduce instances many years ago when a poor woman used to bring me money in Boston. I should place her name on the memorial tablet in our yeshiva. And she used to count, used to charge $100 for a clerk. And she used to count the money and her hands were trembling. And one quarter and another quarter and a third quarter and a fourth quarter. And I used to ask her, tell me, my dear lady, how much savings do you have? What's my last savings? It's all the time of the depression. So why do you give the money to the yeshiva? You can't afford to do it. The Rebbe, Yechviva Mezor, Manish Tagesim, I want to be remembered. Once I will die, I know my children will never remember me. They'll never come to shul to say, Yiske, perhaps the yeshiva will remember once in a while that I was an old woman. And this is not just the mentality of a primitive, unlettered, illiterate woman, but a very honest one, a sincere one. This is the mentality of Western man. When Johnson accepted the vice presidency offered by Kennedy, and it was a degrading acceptance, I would say disgraceful acceptance, so one of the journalists asked him, why did you accept it? After all, as majority leader of the Senate, you have wielded so much power and influence, actually. The president was, you commanded the respect of the White House, and now the vice president, you know what the vice president means in America. You'll just be an errand boy for the president. So he answered him, yes, yes. But history will give two more lines to the vice president than to the majority leader of the Senate. History will devote a few more words to the vice president than to the majority leader of the Senate. Power at present means nothing. I'll be remembered. That's what Johnson said. And Johnson is not a metaphysician, nor a philosopher, nor a man of exceptional spiritual perceptions. Even though he acted like a man as far as Eretz Yisrael is concerned. But this is correct. And Yahadu's demands of man are non-limiting. Let me give you an example. There are many boys who study Gemara here. But how many girls are here who study Gemara, I don't know. But boys like Manuel. Tell me, you study Mishnah. Star Mishnah. Or you study Mishnah and there's a controversy with an individual. And we call him the Tanekame. Who is the Tanekame? Who is he? So you ask me, who the Tanekame? You answer me, you ask who the Tanekame is? This is the majority of Jewish scholars. What are their names? Who is the Tanei Basra? You don't know. Tanei Rabbeinu. Who are the Rabbeinu? Who are they? Why was the Brahis Yavarao records were so stingy? So tight-lipped in enumerating the names? It is not just a coincidence. It is not laziness or neglect on the part of our Chazal. It's a matter, it's a policy. The greatest of all sacrifices a Jew brings when he's ready to sink into oblivion and remain in the shadows of anonymity. The orgiastic society as well as the tyrannical arrogance of society, attempt to overcome human finiteness, the Minamaki awareness, by substituting public memory for metaphysical immortality. Yehadus did not accept it. On the contrary, it considered the quest for having one's name recorded in history as sheer vanity. The individual, as such, can never become a historical figure. Only the covenantal community is perpetuated by history, as claim an historical immortality. The service which the individual gives to the community is recorded, but his private life is never recorded. The very moment the service is completed, history is not concerned with him anymore. The ideal cathartic experience is that of anonymity. How many texts did the Torah record pertaining to the lives of the patriarchs or Moses? Only those periods were recorded which were directly intertwined with the service they rendered to the covenantal community. There is never a complete biography, only fragments being selected, namely those which tell us about the sacrificial surrender of the individual to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Those who echo the great word Achineni, which rings through endless spaces, I am ready and willing to serve. Nothing else but the Hineni was recorded. It's very strange. We know much more about Aristotle and Socrates and Plato than we know about the Vilna Gaon. I mean biographical data. Very little. What do I know about my father? Very little. He never talked about himself. He never wrote an autobiography. He never reminisced. I just know some episodes. What do I know about the life of my grandfather after crying? Just single episode. He never confided their private affairs, their private experiences, their clandestine emotions to anyone. Whatever happened, happened between them and God. It has never been made public. It's an aspect of anonymity. God requires of man the highest of all sacrifices, anonymity, which is genuine humility. He hates glamour, fame, external glitter, and certainly vainglory. He loves the actor or the actress who appears on the stage for a short while, plays his or her part humbly and disappears immediately without receiving applause. Man stands in the limelight as long as he is the Messiah, the anointed who consecrated himself to the covenantal community. The very moment he finishes his job, the lights are dimmed, or rather extinguished, and he is out of sight. What does the Megillah tell us about Mordechai HaYehudi and Esther HaMalkus? What did the Megillah tell us about Esther HaMalkus' life following the Haman episode? After all, she was a young girl when she was taken to the palace. She lived for many more years. I would like to know
Did she remain the queen in Persia? Or Ahasuerus sent her back to Mordechai and invited Shargash and a boy to find another queen for him. It would have been quite curious to know about it. The Megillah doesn't mention one word. And the story is finished. And she has removed herself from the stage. What do we know about Mordechai Yehudi? What do we know? Nothing. We know the Yetzer Poroshas Guas Mordechai, Asher Gidle HaMelech, Halem Ksubim Al Sefer Divrei HaYomim, the Malchim Mordechai for us. Go ahead and find them and read the story. Yes. One episode, and a very short one, of their lives was recorded. The rest is anonymous. And if somebody would, and that's exactly what Micha said, I gave the Lord on Matthew, Umad Hashem Derish Mimcha, Kimaseis Mishpot, Ve'avas Chesed, Ve'atna Lechet Simen Kecha, It has been told thee, O man, what is God, what the Lord doth require of thee, only to do justly and to walk humbly. I would say rather anonymously. Who is thy God? Anyway, we must underline the word humbly. And this is our answer to the Maki Minamita.